Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And what an exciting season we're entering into after the lazy, hazy, whatever it is, days of summer.
Yep.
Everything's in full swing once again.
We're all over the place. We're all over the place.
We are.
In this week's program.
All the new books are coming out.
And we're going to be all, because we're going to be all over the place.
People are opening restaurants. It's wonderful.
Anyway, so who's up first?
Well, we wanted to give a little plug to something that's very important, which is the Chef's Collaborative Sustainability Summit. And
their whole program about sustainability on the part of chefs. It's an interesting story, an organization that's been around for 20 years, doing what it's doing, doing very interesting and very important things. And
I expect to learn a lot at this conference.
So. Yeah, and you should expect to learn a lot in this next interview coming up with Melissa Kogut.
We're going to be talking to Melissa Kogut. And it's a wonderful opportunity to know about or learn about not only the event that she is working on right now, which we plan to attend, but also the organization she's working with, which is the Chefs Collaborative. Melissa, welcome to On the Menu.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Now, a lot of people will say, now, what exactly is Chefs Collaborative? Could you give us a brief description of what the organization is?
Sure. We're about to celebrate the 20th anniversary of Chefs Collaborative, which is really exciting when you think about when we started 20 years ago, a group of chefs who saw the topic of sustainability as a topic that people weren't discussing. And a decision was made amongst these chefs that we needed to have a national organization that pulled together a network of chefs who are interested in running sustainable restaurants to both support those efforts, increase the number of chefs doing that, and also educate the public.
So it's always been about sustainability.
Yes.
Okay.
That word wasn't even mentioned back in 1993 when the organization was started. So obviously, look ahead to where we are now, and the landscape is very changed.
Yeah, and of course, these are not just routine cooks. These are high-profile chefs.
That's right. A chef that started Chefs Collaborative were chefs like Rick Bayless and nationally known chefs from around the country. Alice Waters was there in the beginning. Jimmy Schmidt, just, you know,
we met Jimmy.
Oh, great. Yeah. He's going to be at our national summit. We're giving him a Pioneer's Table Award. He's been at it a long time and has been a big supporter of the organization.
Now, do you move around your headquarters according to who's director or?
No, it's a little random that we're based in Boston, but it's the way the organization was grew organically, and we were part of another organization when we first started called Blaze, and that organization's based here. So it's just evolved as a Boston-based organization, but we really could be anywhere. I mean, the great thing, though, about being in Boston is we have such a wealth of staff to hire who are knowledgeable about sustainability and several grad programs about sustainable food. So we have great resources for hiring. But we work with chefs around the country, and our summit has been all over. The first one was in Chicago, then we were in Boston last year, in New Orleans, and this year in Seattle, next year Charleston. So we really go around to give chefs around the country a chance to connect with the organization.
Now, we talked to somebody about Old Ways.
Oh.
Several years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Give me a name.
Sarah, now you're Don Gifford.
Don
was
Gifford,
the
Don,
founder,
Don,
and he passed away about a year ago.
Oh, dear. Well, he's on the Menu's audio archive forever, so you can.
That's great.
So you can listen to him anytime you feel like it.
I never got a chance to meet him because he was involved in the organization so many years ago, but people who know him just said he was an extraordinary visionary and really, really was instrumental in the founding of this.
He wrote a book. I think that was the proximate reason that we spoke with him, because he wrote a book about what Old Ways was and what it stood for.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
He was amazing.
Yeah, he was.
Especially since he was so far ahead of his time, as was, you were saying, Chefs Collaborative. Could you tell us a little bit about the issue of sustainability. Seems like everybody uses the term, but how many people really understand what it means?
Well, interestingly, we've just been looking back. We're all going to be meeting in Seattle to take a look at where we are and where we're going. And about 8 years ago, our main goal was just to educate chefs that sustainability is an important concept, believe it or not. And by sustainability, we mean concern for sourcing food responsibly by considering the impact of its production or distribution on the environment and our health, as well as a concern for the future availability of food for future generations. So there's a lot of considerations, and we just wanted people to know it was an important concept. We think that word is widely known right now. I think the meaning is probably different for different people. I think people know in general what it's referring to. What does it look in practice? I think that's where it gets more complicated. And what we do with our member chefs is we help them understand what sustainability looks like with regard to seafood. And we've put out a chef's guide to sustainable seafood as well as an online tutorial for chefs, which is actually available for the public. I actually encourage non-chefs to take this tutorial. It's called Green Chef's Blue Ocean, and it really lays out the issues of sustainability for seafood because it has to do with the health of the species and the fishery, and different things impact the health of a species. It can be overfishing or pollution, any number of the fishing methods. So we want chefs to understand what's at stake and what questions to ask and where the resources are. The same goes for meat and beef and pork, and there's a whole other set of things to understand about that. How was the animal raised? Was it humanely treated? How is waste managed on the farm where the animal grew up? What's the method of slaughter? Are they, you know, is there pesticide use? So understanding all the variables that go into what makes that product sustainable. But not only that, we help address the barriers that chefs have. In some cases, many of them say the grass-fed beef doesn't taste good. So if it doesn't taste good and it's expensive, they're not putting it on the menu. So we address that barrier when we're working with chefs so that it's no longer a barrier, because there are ways to understand that depending on who's raising the animal and where it grew up, it's going to taste differently.
There's great grass-fed beef, and then there's really awful stuff.
Exactly.
In fact, we had great grass-fed beef burgers for lunch today.
Yeah, we did.
Oh, really?
I got a prize. I must have been thinking about you. Now, it's kind of interesting that although the organization's based in Boston, this summit is in Seattle, which is a pretty green kind of place.
Oh, yeah. They really are different than any other place. And I think people are coming because they want to see what to aspire to. There's a lot of passion for sustainable food and health and the environment and composting and recycling, and they're ahead of the curve in just about every way.
Is the is membership of the organization available only to chefs? Or, you know, I'm sure there are more than just chefs that are going to be attending the summit. But
absolutely. Nope. Our target audience is chefs. But we're collaborative. I mean, chefs, our way of working is collaborative, and we can't do this. The chefs can't be successful without working with producers, farmers, fishermen, artisan producers, and members of their own community, and the writers that write about what they're doing. So our membership really reflects that, and we open the membership to anybody. The kinds of programs that we develop, though, are really geared for chefs, because we don't see... There is no organization that's targeting their educational programs or the support that we give to build peer-to-peer networks locally. It's all about helping chefs do what they do better and understanding what they can do to run more sustainable restaurants. There's a chef here in Boston who was one of the early leaders in this organization, and he is still serving commodity beef, even though everything else on his menu is sourced locally or sustainably. He just hasn't figured out yet how to make it work financially. And we're not looking for perfection. We want chefs to really grapple with the challenges and learn from one another. And that's why it's important to have our membership be a broad swath of the food community.
And for people who want to find out more about how to join, it's chefscollaborative.org is the organization. And I'm sure the website takes you wherever you need to go.
Yes, it does. We make it very clear.
And Count, why don't we talk about the summit?
Sure, sure. Well, we better be careful because tickets are in really short supply. if we talk about it too much, Sony might come and steal ours.
That's right. No, you're in. We're looking forward to seeing you there.
But it is a big time event. About how many people are going to be there?
We have room for 300 people, and we try to keep it that size because we want people to develop relationships that they can take back home with them, whether they're in their community or across the country. We want people to get to know each other and connect with each other.
So it's a big event, but it's a small meeting.
Exactly.
But you've got some pretty famous people coming to speak.
We do. We are thrilled that Ruth Reichel, the former editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine, is going to be our keynote speaker. And one of the things she's going to talk about is the fact that chefs really started it all. And I'm looking forward to hearing her. I mean, she's been active in the food community for forever. And
we interviewed her just shortly before the magazine folded. And I was asking her about the direction she was going to take. And one of them actually was devoting more of Gourmet Magazine to issues such as sustainability.
Yeah.
So the only thing, unfortunately, that sustained as a result of that is the trees that would have been knocked down.
I know. We missed that. We missed that magazine.
She's terrific.
Don't we all? And then you've got Kim Severson.
Kim Severson from the New York Times, who is really a blast.
She is incredible.
She was the food writer at the New York Times and then is now the bureau chief over in Atlanta and wrote a book about, a very personal book about food, but she's also very funny. So,
she had some wonderful reporting on the conventions. Especially
she is so funny, and I follow her on Twitter, and she makes me laugh.
Me too.
Now, you've got some local talent in Seattle, though, there, too, like Tom Douglas, who's a pretty funny guy.
Tom Douglas is a really funny guy, and we've got him speaking to the crowd in a couple of different spots. He's going to be he'll be greeting and welcoming everybody to Seattle, and he's also going to be on a panel that Kim Severson is going to be moderating on, do chefs have a responsibility to be advocates? So he'll be joined by two other local chefs, Piper Davis from Portland, Oregon, and Greg Atkinson. And they all have sort of a different view, all very outspoken. It's sort of going to take off where those of you who read the New York Times article about Thomas Keller and his...
Yeah, I figured that's what sparked all this. Yeah.
We wanted to get him to come, but he was busy. But we would love to engage him in that conversation.
Yeah, well, we also interviewed Atkinson. Is it Atkinson?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we interviewed him ages ago.
Did we?
Yeah.
Did we? I don't remember what we did.
I can't remember what the book was.
I can't remember every guest we have. Anyway, you can be sure that we'll be bringing back some interesting reports.
Good. I'm glad to hear from
this event.
And Rowan Jacobson, another good one.
Yeah. Rowan is so wonderful. He's going to be our MC. He really understands the organization and what we do, and he's going to connect the dots between speakers and really bring it all together. And he was with us last year. He's going to be with us again this year. We're really excited to have him back. And he's a star in his own right. I mean, he's written a lot of books. One, The Geography of Oysters, that was, I think, got a Beard Award or IACP Award.
That's the book. I was trying to remember the book. And, of course, we're going to connect up with our old friend, John Rowley, and Bill Taylor from Taylor Fisheries.
Yep, and there's going to be some good eating on Sunday night to welcome all the summit participants, and we'll be tasting local oysters, and John Rowley's an expert on oyster wines. So
I know. that's his handle, whatever you call it.
Yeah, Oyster Wines.
Oyster Wines.
You can follow him on Twitter, but he's going to be bringing a number of wines that just taste delicious with oysters. So.
Yeah, we're going to record a wine and oyster tasting, actually.
With him.
Oh,
it's
good.
We're trying to figure out exactly how to do that, because the recording equipment doesn't like liquids.
It doesn't like slurp.
It's been done with wine before. It's never been done with oysters before.
when you
eat oysters, you make a mess by definition.
Well,
so we're not
maybe quite
sure how we're going to do that, but you may be sure that there'll be some interesting reports coming back. And it turns out that a lot of Seattle chefs are going to be so busy with the event that they're not going to have time to talk to us at their restaurants, but that's the sacrifice that they have to make. Anyway, we're looking forward.
Melissa, you're doing such a great job. I just wanted to get that in. It's a very complicated program to put together, and it's just run smoother than ice.
Okay.
I'm so happy to hear that.
So we're delighted to be a part of it, and we thank you so much for joining us today on the menu.
Well, thanks for having me. Looking forward to seeing you.
Thanks, Melissa. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Now, right after our sponsors have a word, we'll be back with you, so don't go away.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. We're going to venture into, for us, I think, new territory, because
yeah,
we don't do much with Germany.
And we're going in the opposite direction.
Right. Well,
Seattle's to the left and Berlin's to the right.
Right. But this is called a love story with the recipes. And it's
It just turns out that we're going to be in this particular city in the not-too-distant future, but Louisa, what's her last name?
Weiss.
I've forgotten. Louisa Weiss has been there a lot.
Yeah, she spent her childhood half there, half here.
And now she's back there all the time.
Yeah, and it was as the very first, I think, German interview we've done. So it's going to be new territory for us. Interesting. Let's listen to her, please. Anyone interested in a truly delightful memoir, Kuchen Recipes, there's Louisa Weiss's book called My Berlin Kitchen, and which is subtitled A Love Story with Recipes. You might all know Louisa as the creator of The Wednesday Chef, which is a great name. And how did you come up with that name, Louisa?
I came up with that name because food sections at the time in the newspapers were being published only on Wednesdays, and the two newspapers that I followed really closely, the New York Times and the LA Times, their food sections were always published on Wednesdays. So every Wednesday I would clip out these recipes, and I came up with the idea for the blog as a way of working through the recipes. And so I thought, well, I clip them every Wednesday. I don't cook necessarily every Wednesday, but I cook everything from the Wednesday newspaper section. So that's how I came up with the Wednesday.
So you're not Wednesday's child.
No. I'm actually born on a Tuesday.
Okay, well, you can remember. That's very clever.
Well, I was, too, actually.
I don't remember. I don't remember what day of the week it is.
My mother told me. I don't think I would remember otherwise.
Now, I know according to Bishop Usher's Concordance of the Holy Bible that the world was created in 4004 B.C., and I believe it was a Wednesday.
Yeah. Anyhow, Louisa, here is this memoir. You had so many emotional ups and downs. This is a dramatic book.
Yeah, I guess.
Your life is anything but uncomplicated, or has been. Mm-hmm. You were born to an American father from the Boston area, mm-hmm, and an Italian mother in Berlin, and then you were shuffled back and forth, not only between Berlin and the U.S., but also to your mother's Italian relatives in Italy.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, however that happened, you selected France, Paris in particular, for graduate studies, so we added another country there. Anything
mm-hmm
else?
No, I think that was it. I think you got it all.
Yeah. So it's about moving, it's about seeking your real identity. And how did, through all of this, Berlin become your, not literally, at least spiritually, your home?
Well, let's see. I was born in Berlin, and I lived there until I was about 2 or 3 years old. And when my parents got divorced, my father and I moved to Boston, but my mother stayed in Berlin. So not only was Berlin the place where I was born and therefore sort of my psychological home, but that's where my mother lived, and anybody's mother, wherever they live, that's home.
See, I thought that was an unusual arrangement, why you ended up in the States with your father.
Yeah, it was an unusual arrangement. Most people end up with their mother, but that was the way they decided to do things. And I can't say that I loved it, but when I was 10, I moved back to live with my mother, and that's good.
But you seem to, your mother seems to be a pillar of security in all this.
Yeah, absolutely. Both of my parents did their very best, despite the divorce, to be really good parents. My mother would come and visit us in Boston a lot, and I spent all my summer and winter holidays from school with her in Berlin or in Italy with our family. So, yeah, they split it up as best they could. They didn't want to have a big custody battle over me, and so the way they managed to work it out was to have me going back and forth between the two of them.
Now you're back in Berlin, and Berlin,
well, that's the end of
Berlin
the story.
Is home.
That's the, you're jumping in.
Oh, okay. Well, it's more interesting to take things out of sequence every once in a while. You call
it Berlin is definitely home. Definitely, definitely. I feel very much like I have come full circle. It was what I'd always sort of hoped to do, but I felt like I couldn't because of work and career obligations in New York and this perceived feeling I had that I couldn't really find an adult reason to be in Berlin. So I feel like now that I'm finally there and we have a good life, I'm very, very, very happy about it.
Yeah, we'll get to that, too, because that had to deal with love and marriage, and we should mention you just had a baby.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the other love story here is your love of cooking,
mm-hmm.
which it's interesting because it was a safety island for you because you're not a particularly big eater. How did you come, besides your genes here, with Italian genes? And then I guess you also got some genes out of your dad's side. Didn't his mother live in Israel?
No, she never did, no.
Oh, somebody's mother lived in Israel, right?
Oh, right, my ex-fiancé's mother.
Okay.
She lived in Israel, yeah. How I got into cooking, how cooking became such a safety net, well, I don't really know, because my mother, as I write in the book, didn't particularly love to spend time in the kitchen. She's a very good cook, and she was very diligent. She always cooked for me, always had dinner on the table, but she was always very obvious that it was just sort of a duty more than a pleasure. My father is a little bit more into cooking. I suspect that has a lot to do with his wife, who's a very, very, very good cook. So I'm not entirely sure where my ambitions in the kitchen came from, except that my nanny, the woman who took care of me when I was a child, who's a very, very close friend of our family, she's sort of like my second mother. She's an incredible baker, and from my sort of earliest memories are in her kitchen, watching her cook and smelling the things that she made. And more than anything, those moments really cemented themselves in my head as what a happy home smells like and what a happy family is. And I think that when I was little, just really little, I don't know, I'm saying 8 or 9 years old, she was the one who first taught me how to make cookies or bake bread and things like that. And I think, I wouldn't say that she's 100% the driving force behind my desire to be in the kitchen, but she certainly lit the fire without a doubt. And then I realized that it was something that I really enjoyed doing. I started cooking a little bit in high school to sort of help my mom out and realized that I just really enjoyed it, and it really relaxed me and made me feel competent and good and creative. And one thing led to the next, and my father was giving me a pot for my 19th birthday, and
that's the green pot.
And a sharp knife.
Yeah.
A couple years later, and just one thing led to the next.
And you had that old cookbook.
Yeah, I've had cookbooks by my bedside to read before bedtime, as I suspect many, many people do. I think probably more people buy cookbooks to read in bed than they cook from.
I loved when you were talking about your Addie Boney cookbook. It was.
You know that book? So many people know it.
I have it. I have it.
Oh, good. Wonderful. Yeah, that's a real classic.
It is. So anyhow, the book is not only the story of your life and the process of the self-discovery and the achievement of happiness, you also provide the reader with, are these recipes that are, they mean something special to you? And some of them are from some other place. Do you make up any of them?
A few of them are made up. Now I need to have the book in front of me to jog my memory. It's been a few months. But, yes, some of them are sort of special home concoctions that I put together based on memories or whatever. But a lot of them are either taken from my family's recipes or cribbed from other much, much more gifted cooks than me.
No, I just said to Peter, you know why we don't make Brussels sprouts with the coloratura? Because we have a whole bottle of coloratura that's probably 6 years old. I don't think it ever spoils.
No, I don't think it does. You got to wait for the next Brussels sprouts to come in.
Exactly.
Curious enough, we're getting some now. I'm not sure where they're coming from, but we...
Oh.
Whole Foods has them right now. I wish I knew where they came from.
Maybe they come from down south. Do you think they're already on root vegetables?
Well,
it's a winter vegetable.
Certainly my native land are a cold... weather vegetable. In fact, they're the only vegetables available in cold weather just about. I'm sure the same is true in Germany, too.
A lot of these recipes are, I would call, comfort foods, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and do people write and say that they're cooking their way through your book? Like you were so, Julie, you were so interested in her cooking her way through Julia Child's book.
Yeah.
Louisa, do you think that what's going to happen is people are going to cook their way through your book?
Well, I would be totally thrilled if they did. I don't think that'll be the same. First of all, I don't, obviously I'm not Julia Child, but second of all, that was a real cookbook with, I don't know, hundreds and hundreds of recipes. I think it was 125. My book is more of a narrative with recipes that I hope people will enjoy. I certainly worked hard to make them and enjoyable, but I don't expect anybody to start up a project.
Now,
You have one huge advantage over Julia Child.
I'm still alive.
Well, the first one is you have a blog, and the second is you're still here to create it. Seems almost like cheating, doesn't it?
Louisa, you found enormous success with this blog. I mean, how many followers do you have?
I think I have something around 90,000 readers a month.
Holy Moses, that's incredible.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's totally crazy, but yeah.
But you communicate very closely with them, apparently, huh?
Yeah, I feel really attached to my readers. I obviously don't know them in the traditional sense, but many of them have been reading they've been reading for a long time, and I feel like I don't know where I would be without, I wouldn't have written the book if it hadn't been for my readers.
And it's
so I feel very indebted to them, very, very attached.
And it's www.wednesdaychef.com.
The Wednesday Chef.
The
Wednesday. Isn't it The Wednesday Chef?
Yep, there's a the in there. Yeah, Wednesday Chef was taken, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's how we got On the Menu Radio. It was On the Menu, but that was taken, so we did the radio.
Okay,
it's thewednesdaychef.com. And is that case sensitive or not?
It's not, but you have to put the www in front of it. Remember, Louisa was telling us that before we came on the air.
Mm-hmm.
What did these people say to you? What is the reason why you hit this nerve in so many people?
I'm not really sure. I think a lot of people clip recipes, especially from the New York Times. I think I'm certainly not alone in having had that obsession for many years. And when I started my blog, I got comments from a lot of readers saying, I've been clipping those same recipes for years, and I've always wondered if anybody else out there was testing them. And so I think that at the beginning there were people who were interested just because we were interested in this, we were getting our tips from the same place, so to speak. And then as the months and years went by with my blog, and it so slowly shifted from being less of a straight food blog into more of a personal thing, I started writing a little bit more about my life online and sort of weaving stories out of my personal life into the posts I would write about the recipes I tried. I started getting far more responses, really heartfelt ones, people relating to what I experienced or empathizing or sympathizing. And I don't know, it just sort of turned into this incredibly warm place for me, certainly. I have to assume that my readers felt feel similarly.
So without
I think it's a sort of a mixture between it being a cozy, you know, it's nice to sit around and talk about what you made for dinner. That's something that appeals to a lot of people. And then sort of having it be also a place where people can read about a person's life or what she chooses to share, and they can identify with what I've written.
Did they all go yay when you moved back to Germany and reconnected with Mac?
Yeah, I think so. I think they were pretty happy for me.
Well, you better be careful. You better not give away too much. This book only just came out.
Yep.
You want it to soar to the top of the Amazon.com bestseller list.
I'm crossing my fingers.
We had somebody on the program, I can't remember who it was, and around the time they interviewed, their book soared to number 5 on the New York Times best book list, and it was the day after Martha Stewart interviewed the author on TV.
Oh my goodness.
So she still has some influence, whether it's good or bad, I'm not sure, but she still has some.
So it wasn't
good for her. Well, that's amazing.
It was the most unlikely. It was a rather obscure book.
Anyhow, well, tell Berlin that we'll be seeing her soon. Is it a she or a he?
I think Berlin is a he, actually.
Okay. All right.
I'll tell him you'll be seeing him soon.
We'll be seeing him soon. And I'm sorry we're going to cross paths and not see you.
Sorry about that, too, but I'll have some tips.
That's great.
Well, we'll look forward to that. About the only thing I know about the about Berlin is it's on the River Spree, or the River Spray, depending on how you care to pronounce it.
Yep, that's right.
And there are some massive monuments that have become familiar, and one very unpleasant monument, which is
gone.
Come and gone, thank goodness.
Thank goodness, indeed.
Somebody I was corresponding with early on about where to stay and that kind of thing said, remember, Peter, Berlin's the third most popular tourist destination in Europe after London and Paris.
That's true.
So there are going to be a lot of people there. And I was double-checking our reservations today and seeing if I could get a better rate at one of the hotels. It sold out.
Oh, my goodness.
So it's a good job I booked it some time ago.
Yeah, well, we're so excited. And I hope you have a good book tour when you're in the States, too. And I hope
Thank you so much.
Yeah, and I hope this book soars on the... I mean, you really deserve it.
Thank you. Yeah. That's so kind.
Louisa...
And don't forget that blog.
I'm
reminding our listeners.
TheWednesdayChef.com.
Yeah, I could hardly get a word in edgeways. That's pretty usual, though.
All right, Louisa.
Have a great trip to Berlin. Thank you so much.
And we'll be right back after a 20-second word from our sponsors, so please don't go away.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Jim Leahy's an expert in pizza, and John Baricelli's an expert in everything to do with baking. So we decided we might as well put them back to back in a segment. So
John Baricelli's first, and he's actually a repeat guest a second time around here, which means that he's been around for a while, and so have we.
It also means he's very good.
And he is good, and he has the Sono Baking Company. And this is the kind of cookbook about baking that has recipes that you would love to make every single day.
You can make them at home. He says so because he says I made them there before I made them at the bakery.
He tested them at home, which is God bless us.
he actually said, I think, that he made most of them at home while he was getting ready to found his bakery.
Right, and then we're going to move on to, I mean, he's the guru of no-need bread.
And no-need pizza.
And no-need pizza.
But he makes
it sound so easy.
But don't be frightened. We know you need pizza. It's just spelled differently.
Yes.
How clever.
But how many wonderful toppings he has for your pizza once you get this crust thing down.
You bet. So,
he's such a nice guy.
Is it Jim first? Is John?
No. John Baricelli is
John,
first.
John first, Jim second. That's pretty hard to figure out. So... Please enjoy.
Well, we always like to re-interview or re-meet or reassemble together with one of our former stars. And here we have John Baricelli, who was with us a couple of years ago with his first book, Sono Baking Company cookbook. And now you're out, John, with a new one, which sort of, as I can tell, takes it back to less from the bake shop and more to the home kitchen. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct.
Okay, so now we don't have anything else to talk to about the whole rest of the interview. I'm just teasing. John, how long has your bake shop been open?
It's open 7 years this July, so we're starting our eighth year.
Yeah.
And it's going well. We opened a second location.
Oh, really? Where?
I remember that. I remember that you had a new place, yes.
Yeah, in Westport, Connecticut, a little nicer location.
Uh-huh.
And we're looking for our third location as we speak.
And where are you looking?
We're looking in the Saugatuck section of Westport, which is actually in between the two stores that we have now.
Oh, that's good.
There's a new hip neighborhood that's coming up, and we think we have a good opportunity.
What's it called, the hip neighborhood?
The Saugatuck section of Westport.
Oh, wow. Westport. Okay. All right.
Right off of 95.
Anyhow, so these recipes are more geared to the home cook or home baker, and you say they're easy, but they're not dull. They're very tasty and appealing.
Oh, they're wonderful. They're a little more kid-friendly, I would say. So you get the whole family involved. Every recipe has a fruit or a vegetable in it, which is what we're encouraging people to go to the local market and bring home what's in season and prepare it.
Okay, so that's where the seasonal in the title comes from.
Correct.
We didn't say that, but the book's actually termed the seasonal baker.
That's really
correct.
The title, and just to make sure everybody knows. The seasonal baker. Easy.
We do three farmers markets a week, so we're always bringing back the local produce and processing it and bringing it to the next market. So it works out very well.
And you do, in this cookbook, both sweet and savory.
Yes. Well, we did some savory in the last recipe. In fact, we did, I don't know if you remember, a delicious tomato cobbler, and we did a chicken pot pie. And so we did some savory in the last book, but we kind of emphasized a little bit more on the family aspect, where you would have a grilled pizza where everybody does their own toppings. And again, we did ice creams because we know how much ice creams are adored by entire families. So we tried to be really down home, what my favorite recipes are that I do for my house when I make my my product.
Now, like, what are some of your favorites?
No, I'm a big ice cream fan. in fact, I'm dusting off my, I have a soft serve ice cream machine that the kids get a kick out of, so we're going to start doing soft serve. Believe it or not, I think we eat more ice in the winter because we're home more and it gets dark earlier. So we tend to make our own ice cream more in the winter. And in the summer, when you're out and you're running about till 8, 9 o'clock at night, you always stop off and get ice cream somewhere.
Uh-huh.
For a lot of home bakers, it must be a bit threatening to be approaching a cookbook written by someone who's become famous for having such a great baker that he's now going on his third and doing farmers markets as well. How do you go about the process of taking a recipe idea that's a commercial one and making it suitable for someone like me to be able to cook?
Well, see, I think it actually goes the other way. These recipes were my home recipes that I had to make into commercial ones. So it's a little bit of both, but I understand that sometimes thinking that it's a bakery, quote-unquote, recipe, that it would be a little bit more different. But if you look at every recipe, it has the exact ingredients that we use here at the bakery, only on a smaller scale. We only use butter. We only use extra virgin olive oil. We use the best of the flour. We use the best of the seasonal ingredients. Farm fresh eggs. We don't use any pasteurized eggs or cracked eggs, I guess they call them. So everything that we do here at the bakery is easily transformed to a home recipe because it's basically just a deduction. And vice versa. If I run into a good home recipe from a friend or a family member, it's very easily adaptable because I have everything here on premise. So my recipes always float back and forth from house to home. I mean, from house to business.
Yeah, Anne's got, she's opened a page with watermelon wedges with ginger and lime.
Now,
I guess the only question I have is, what flavor ice cream do you have with that?
They're called smiles. Can you see that?
Okay.
They look like smiles. They're really cute.
What is that now? I'm sorry.
You said you called these watermelon smiles, and they
look
like smiles.
Yeah, they do.
And it says that your daughter borrowed this recipe for your daughter, Nola.
Yeah, that's, yeah. She's my 13-year-old. She turns 13 December. She's quite an eater.
And it comes from Lucinda Scala Quinn.
Yeah, it was one of my co-hosts on Everyday Food.
Okay, I was going to say, you're good friends, yeah. Your pies, your fruit pies look absolutely wonderful.
Thank you.
Well, what do you do? I think we talked about this before, but maybe not that much. What do you do about this whole gluten-free stuff? It's getting to the point where, first of all, it's the fastest-growing segment of the specialty food market, and everybody or every other person you talk to has gluten intolerance.
We are an open-walled bakery. So, in other words, the bread section touches over to the pastry section, touches over to the chef's station. So tell people, listen, we're not baking in a gluten-free environment. So we can tell you what has flour, what doesn't have flour. We can tell you that it's 100% spelt. We can tell you that we take great care not having certain allergens on premise. But what we can't guarantee you is that there is no cross-contamination. And people take that with a great bit of honesty, and they say, well, you know, if somebody is really, really allergic to or has a serious allergy, we're very careful about what we sell them. You know, even the fact that an almond croissant touches a regular croissant could get somebody, you know, extremely ill. So we don't use peanuts on premise. Yes, gluten is one of those things that either people are doing it for dietary reasons or they are severely reacting to the gluten. So,
you know, it's a costly thing, too. We just had a remodeling done, and our contractor was recently diagnosed with celiac. And so
right. This
is all new to him. But we do have a gluten-free bakery in town, and he could buy gluten-free flour there, but it's like $15 a pound or something.
Right.
Yeah, so, I mean...
Yeah, we went through our product list, and I have it right in front of me. You know, so these are items that we make here every day that have no flour. It's granola, our almond macaroons, our chocolate flourless roulade, our coconut macaroons, French macaroons, meringue cup. We do Sarah Bernhardt's, strawberry mousse hearts, triple mousse triangles. All these items are completely flour-free. But then we throw in that line that it is processed in a kitchen that has flour. Obviously, we're a bread bakery also. So there's always a mist of flour in the air. How do you tell somebody that there is no flour product when you know deep down inside that there's always flour in the air? We do make stuff that is gluten-free. We tell people our situation, and they use their judgment. And a lot of times our flourless brownies are sufficient for people, even though we dust the cake pan with a little bit of flour, and sometimes they're not. So we're open, we're honest, and that's how we deal with the situation.
Yeah, I love that you bring back some old-fashioned desserts here. Like, I grew up in these date squares. They weren't popular in the 50s, right?
See, a lot of times when I was younger, my mother would make a special dessert for our birthday or something like that. So we all got to pick.
And this was yours?
That was mine.
Your other favorites. There's so many here, I don't know where to start. There's just so many.
The panna cotta I love, and I love all the crisps and the cobblers, and, you know, the muffins. That pumpkin muffin is just fantastic. I had one yesterday. When we do a book signing here, I always bring samples. So if it's a morning book signing, the morning pastries, and if it's an afternoon one, I'll bring something that's more appropriate for afternoon and for evening. But the sour cherry chocolate chunk cookies are just absolutely incredible. And one thing that I hear constantly is that our recipes work. And they look as good as the picture, and people are very pleased with the results they get from the book. So that makes us feel very good. Not only are we giving out authentic, true Sono Bakery and my home recipes, but we're giving out quality recipes that actually work.
Now, that doesn't cause you to have difficulty with business at the bakery, though.
No.
So even though people can make it at home, they still want to come and have yours.
Yeah, it's a lot easier and a lot less time consuming.
And also a lot more likely to be 100% successful.
But listen, the one thing that we'll always have over everybody else is that we're true professionals. We make everything in the artisan way. You can't do that at home with four kids running around you and
dog
going out and the kids getting sick. You know, it's just baking is one of those things that takes time. It really does. And you have to set aside a few hours, especially you're going to make your doughs an hour in advance and on. No pie takes less than an hour and a half in the oven, no matter what you say. So baking's a 3-4 hour process. It's not as instantaneous as cooking, where you throw a few eggs and some fresh herbs in a pan and you have a beautiful omelet. it's one of my favorite lunches, an omelet with a salad. Baking's not that way.
No. You know,
there's a lot of prep and a lot of organization and equipment and oven space and everything else that has to happen.
You know what I think? And you have a number of testimonials or endorsements on your Jack. I love, of course, this is one baker that I trust absolutely. Every single recipe I've ever had of hers is perfect, is Dory Greenspan.
Yeah.
And what does she turn around and says, quote, so many chefs talk about recipes that could be made at home simply, easily, and successfully, but John Baricelli delivers. His sweets are the kind that you want to bake for friends and family, and just the kind that even beginning bakers can turn out. You will make these recipes year-round, and you'll make them over and over again. And I think that sums up this book.
Yeah, she's a good woman, and we appreciate everything she said about the book.
Well, I love the book. I think it's a keeper.
And, no, thank you very much.
Yeah, and
you must come back and see us again when you come out with another book.
Yeah,
another 2 years we'll give it. How's that?
Another two years. Okay, and we won't ask you what it'll be just yet because we want it to be a surprise.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
John, thank you so much for joining
us, John.
On the menu.
All right. We'll see you soon. Bye.
Bye. Jim Lay, your Sullivan Street Bakery, accompanying restaurant, much loved. I mean, did you ever expect that you would have a business that actually drew such passion?
Yes and no. I mean, I think when we opened Co, the intent was to really try to kind of integrate with the community there in that neighborhood and kind of become a neighborhood place.
Uh-huh. You've written a book on bread making, introducing your special no-knead process procedure of making bread. And this one is a follow-up book called My Pizza, the easy no-knead way to make spectacular pizza at home. I have to admit that I have never tried your no-knead method.
Uh-huh.
Primarily because my only fun in making bread is the kneading.
Uh-huh.
But I understand it really works. This book is about the toppings concept of what pizza really can be.
I think that making the dough is fun.
Mm-hmm.
But I think building the pizza and eating is more fun, in a sense.
How did you get to this from studying sculpture?
Well, it's not different from looking at my art when I was kind of practicing was more process-oriented. So I think when I started making pizza or bread, which is a lot of repetition, it's about kind of keeping each time that you execute or make something as if it was the first and last time you did it. So it's kind of, I think that's what one tries to accomplish, but I think when one's working in a restaurant or one's in food service, I think that sometimes people can kind of go through the motions.
Well, now,
I got into it basically as a way of kind of fundamentally communicating ideas to people.
Do you keep inventing new pizza toppings or what?
Well, I think about ingredients all the time.
Yeah.
And think about things that traditionally may not have gone together or reflect and try to make things with things that you know damn well go together, mm-hmm. You know?
Like the basic tomatoes, cheese.
Yeah, well, I mean, tomatoes, cheese, or bread and cheese might be kind of connected, but things that you may not think of putting together people do think of putting together spinach and bread, but maybe not in the form of a pizza. Or in the case of my pizza, it's about not looking at pizza as only tomatoes and cheese, but really looking at all the possibilities that are out there.
Which are endless,
Yeah. I mean, also just like rethinking the pie pizzas that we have are vegan. So we get to address a lot of different palates and tastes.
Now, there is one thing that you don't have in your recipe that I read all the way through, which is something that they do in, sadly, I'm afraid, in my native land, which is to put pineapple on pizza.
Oh, disgusting.
Oh, pineapple, right?
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to leave out the things that have already been kind of popularized or rolled out. I'm sure at some point I'll try to find some way of doing a pineapple pie, maybe not quite as maltsy as the tomato pineapple pie, but maybe I'll do something different.
Now, you have one fundamental principle you stayed up front, which I think is one of the most important things people can take away from this entire conversation. You basically say whatever you're going to put on it, make sure it's absolutely the best of that.
Well, that goes without question. I think we have a lot of amazing small farms in the U.S., and there's a lot of local agriculture. And so right now, for example, you can get the most amazing tomatoes. I, in fact, just last week got some Hungarian paste tomatoes, which kind of look like San Marzano, except they have even less seed. And I guess with this extra dry, extra hot summer we've had here in the Northeast, they're like some of the best tomatoes I've ever had in my life.
Now, how do you organize this? Do you have a certain way you organize it?
How do I organize?
Yeah, so that people have a way of using it. I mean, you break it down into different chapters. What are the classifications of pizza?
Oh, yeah, well, we just classify them as red sauce, white sauce, no sauce.
Uh-huh.
And in this case, it's familiar and the known. And you know, I even, in the book, show people it's kind of silly, but taking tomatoes that are really, really ripe, and rather than buying a food processor just use your hands and squeeze them.
Yeah, I see you squeezing them here.
and it's kind of a fun way of just kind of getting people to reconnect with food and not be afraid of it as well. I mean, the book really is meant for people to open up and have fun with the process, not get so caught up with things look perfect, but just really going more on how things, how ingredients kind of meld together. And then a lot of the pizza ideas, all the pizza ideas in the great, and I thought it was a really fun book to make as well.
Have you made all these? Have they passed through the menu at Sullivan Street Bakery, or did you?
No, the pizzas in my pizza have all been at one time part of company's repertoire.
Yeah.
Company is my restaurant, 24th Street and 9th Avenue in Manhattan.
Okay, got it.
And there we actually practiced some other pizzas, and we've added since the book was published, at least completed as a document over a year and a half, 2 years ago. We have come up with modifications and improvements. So it's, cool. It's an ongoing process. I think, trying to look at a tired old cliche with new eyes. And I'd have to say there's no food genre that's more tired and old and cliche
than pizza.
And as of late has had like a resurgence, a renaissance, if you will, than is pizza. You know, even Domino's and Pizza Hut are now all aboard the artisan pizza craze. You know, they've already kind of launched their huge PR machine. And
give us your opinions. You have fairly defined opinions.
I have no opinions at all. I'm the least opinion person in the restaurant world in New York City, I would say. I'm pretty much.
What about margarita?
Again, it's so classic. It's so beautiful. It's so, can you touch it? It's a classic combination. I adore it.
And do you vary? That's a thin crust. Do you vary the type of crust you use?
No, I think what people have to get away from is this feeling that they need to create a crust or a puffy edge, thereby overhandling the dough, thereby kind of lingering with or playing with the dough too long. Because at that point, when the work of making something is about playing with the ingredients, it's no longer about making the thing you desire to eat. It's about your personal desire to play with ingredients. When I cook, I kind of think of it like I'm trying to make food to feed people. I don't necessarily want to play with the ingredients, but that's not to be said that to come up with an idea, you need to play. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. I understand.
And so it's all about I'm sure you have friends, Anne or Peter, that, or maybe you guys secretly do, and I don't know, practice pizza making at home and are like the bomb when it comes to making, throwing the impromptu pizza party on a Thursday night. If you don't practice it, you don't really know. And then, of course, not everyone has a brick oven in their backyard or knows exactly how to work their oven. I mean, the book really is like a basic how-to, just like have a pizza party as well, and just try all these and beautifully calibrated ideas, the Brussels sprout pizza or the fennel.
Uh-huh.
And sausage pizza, if you know, exquisite. The shiitake mushroom is one of my favorite because it's a very strong statement of vegan thinking in food.
No, are you vegan?
No. I eat everything.
Uh-huh.
But I think I go through binges where I just want to eat red meat.
Are you talking about the Brussels sprouts and chestnut pie?
Yeah.
That sounds fabulous. That's absolutely fabulous.
And a fennel sausage pizza as well.
Oh,
that's exquisite.
Let's go back for just a sec. We sort of missed something out, I think, along the way. At least I think we might have. Because you said this is designed for the home pizza maker.
Yeah.
And as best I could tell, aside from the process of how you make your dough and the ingredients you assemble, which itself is somewhat specialized, about the only really
special piece of equipment you need is a pizza stone.
Yeah. If you didn't have a peel, you could even make it work without a peel.
Right, but I mean, basically, you're saying you use your home oven to do this.
Yeah.
And all you really need to do is it will be improved if you have a pizza stone as well.
Yeah, and the thicker.
And
the thicker the pizza stone, the better. That's all I have to say. Process has shown thin pizza stones can undergo extreme thermal shock. What we've learned. So thicker pizza stone, better pizza stone.
Okay.
So it was, yes.
I've had so many varieties of pizza, including Mother's Little Helper, which I used to make when we were in D.C., where I would save up all the leftovers, whatever they were, and plop them on a pizza.
But you never tried one with quail eggs.
That's what I was just about to lead up to. I never, ever even had one with quail eggs.
Mm.
And you like that. You have a couple in here like that.
Yeah, you have Bird's Nest. Uh-huh. It's one of my favorite asparagus pizza.
Oh, that sounds fabulous, too.
Yeah.
You know, Peter wants one of these. I can't remember which one he wants with the egg.
There's nothing nicer. And if you happen to have truffles.
Yeah, I'm looking at that one.
Even if you have those kind of shaved truffles in oil and not fresh truffles, I entreat you to make the asparagus pizza fresh truffles on top. It's really special.
And we took them to a restaurant and we got all these Oregon truffles, which really didn't taste all that wonderful. But we took them to a restaurant that makes interesting pizza, and she had a ball with them. A lot of her cooks had never even seen a truffle.
Yeah, they didn't even know what a truffle was. I guess if you cook in most pizza shops, you don't know what a truffle is by definition.
Yeah, most people don't. Yeah, that's the thing, too. I mean, pizza's kind of stayed, at least culturally and socially, and typically when we think of pizzerias, they were an entrepreneurial project of the post-Second World War generation, many different kind of ethnic groups, and not only Italians, but Irish, Catholic post-veterans, African-American post-veterans of the Second World War opened a pizzeria. It was like the thing to do.
Is that what happened?
I'm saying that then you know, it's like the golden age of the pizza parlor. And then, you know, I think that, you know, it's almost like a lot of type of entrepreneurial activity at a very particular period in time with a very particular kind of expectation about the product was. I'm sure the pizza that was being made in pizza parlors in the 1960s is not exactly the same in substance as the pizza that was being made in the 1990s. I bet the cheese was probably better in the 60s. I'm not saying the tomato sauce was, but who knows? Or it was worse. I don't know. I can't imagine, like, looking at mass pizza culture, like most of the pizzerias that are out there.
Oh, I know.
That it was, yeah. But I remember, like, when I was a kid growing up, having some awesome pizza. Awesome, awesome pizza.
We still have some. I mean, they're family things. They've gone on for like three generations. Is this your daughter in one of the pictures?
Yeah, on my shoulders.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's my
adorable.
There's one other very interesting chapter in here. The book, no book is complete, I guess, without having some desserts on the end. So we mustn't forget that there's some of those. But the most intriguing chapter, I thought, was the one where you had little appetizers, soups and appetizers. So,
yes.
so that you could keep people amused while their pizza was
exactly
getting ready.
Obviously, because when you're making a pizza party or cooking pizza, you can never make enough fast. I mean, you can, but it goes really quick. Someone has to be dedicated. I think it's good if you have a table, if you have a party of six, everyone takes their turn and makes a pie. That's the most democratic way of doing it. That way everyone gets to sit at the table and you never know what you're going to get.
Everyone
probably tries to outdo the last person somewhere, right?
At local culinary school, we had a meeting for the women chefs and tours, and that's what they did. They put out, they already made the dough, and they put it out, and then you got to take all whatever you wanted for your own personal pizza, and then the oven was there, professional oven, and then it went, and that was more fun. Yeah.
I think everyone would have to be given a really good demonstration first. But even then, it's sort of like, because I teach pizza classes all the time, it's hard for people to really, it seems like it's hard for people to get it sometimes.
What's hard to get? I mean, you're not trying to teach them to throw it like you do. You're not trying to teach them to throw the pizzas up in the air.
That's true. Well, that becomes very messy as well. That means a lot of cleaning for someone. When you have three kids, we don't throw pies. Only for photo shoots do we throw pies.
Well, I think that it must be a child's dream.
If I'm in a desperate rush, I'll throw a pie.
But you have three kids?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that must be an amazing situation for them to have a dad who makes pizza all the time. It's great.
It is when they like to eat it. When they like to eat it. But usually they do.
I have a slightly offbeat question to ask. Is it true what I've read about these pizza wars in New York? I mean, is it a cutthroat kind of a competition there?
I think that in the culture, the general culture of the pizza parlor, not the one that's happening now, because it's either dollar joints, old establishments. There's like a whole kind of Albanian generation of pizza workers that took over their Italian-American or Albanian. I mean, you know, it's kind of broken up into a whole bunch of different groups. Obviously, at one point in time, there was an article published in New York Magazine about pizza wars and mafia connections to pizzerias.
Oh, right. I think I read that. Yeah.
Which is what I thought you were referring
to.
Yeah,
well, I mean, I see that, yeah. But I'd
say generally that in the culture of the pizza joint, there's this sort of like kind of underhanded, sleazy, like you walk by the pizza parlor in the shopping mall and people just moving slices around because they're bored out of their minds. Or just like the culture of like making pizza before people need it. Like, you know, when you go to a pizza joint, and you see all these pies there that people are just waiting to cut up and reheat.
Uh-huh.
I don't get that.
It's terrible.
But it's everywhere. What's that about? You can't cook it for me fresh? We have to make it for me like 4 hours ago? What's that about? I don't want to eat pizza that's 4 hours old.
Right.
You know, it's so weird. You know, I want fresh food, not reheated.
Right.
You know, it's kind of a weird kind of culture, and it's kind of what we're all programmed to think of when we think of pizza, for the most part. And that pervasively bad, low-end, I like to call it dog shit pizza. just because it is. It's bad. It's just bad food. It's like all industrially processed crap that no one cares about. No, there was no value to the cow's life. There was no value to the tomato. There was. It was certainly obliterated by the way that it was turned into a cheese food product or some type of disgusting over-seasoned tomato sauce.
Well, I think that the people who want to escape from that treadmill of the shit pizza should get your book, My Pizza, for inspiration as well.
Yeah, now I know by saying this I'm going to piss a lot of people off.
I don't think so.
But at the end of the day, it's like I think pizza we should be eating pizza all the time.
I know.
Pizza's like the best thing to eat.
Yep, except spinach bread. That's good, too.
Yeah. Anyway, Ann and Peter, I guess this is the end of the interview, huh?
Yeah, and I really enjoyed talking to you, and I could hardly wait to meet you in person.
When you come to New York, let me know. I'll give you a tour, and maybe we could even bake some pizza together or something.
Oh, that would be wonderful.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, everybody should get this book, and the photos are... Oh, you'll be in the kitchen making pizza.
All those pizzas were made in my home oven. Every single pizza in that book was made in a home oven. The oven I use is an older Gen Air, but any oven. I mean, the recipes at the end of the day get calibrated to deal with any oven, not mine. But it's really about getting the floor of the oven at about 600 degrees and then having enough heat from the top of the broiler, and that can mimic pretty much the same quality and intensity of heat you'd have in a brick oven.
Well, that's good to know, too. All these little details. But you're really encouraging me to go experiment in the kitchen, Jim. So I thank you, and
good luck with your book.
and hope to meet you soon.
Yes.
Well, there you are, listeners. Another Sunday, another On the Menu program. We hope you'll join us again, same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.